Welcome to the podcast of the Sunday Celebration from the Center for Spiritual Living in Huntsville, Alabama. We hope you feel the grace, the beauty, and the love of our community as you hear the message of the week.
So brilliant, you moved your clocks back an hour. And so if you're out there in virtual world, or if you're here at the Center for Spiritual Living, I invite you to enter into this holy instant with me, realizing that time is an illusion. And even though we live in a time-bound world, ultimately all any of us has really is the now. You can reference that by observing your breath. The breath doesn't cling to previous moments when it breathed. It doesn't anticipate future moments when this will be an enlightened breath, perhaps. But the breath knows that it exists for the now. And so by placing our attention on that sacred breath, we witness the in-breath and the out-breath. And we can even surrender even more deeply by realizing that we don't breathe. The breath is breathing us. Now we can regulate it by having long, deep inhalations. We can do pranayama exercises, which I did for years and years and years, where we manipulate the breath. Or we can just surrender into the natural ebb and flow of this life-giving essence that is spirit itself. Spirit was never born and spirit never dies. And the more we begin to know ourselves as a spiritual being, having a human experience, we begin to develop a different mind. Not a local mind that is about me and my plans and my future and my past and my story. That mind falls away, and what Eckhart Tolle calls the no mind begins to awaken. A mind that is free of concern and thought and worry and judgment and opinion and preference. A mind that is empty, and yet a mind that is very alive with curiosity and fascination. And what John O'Donohue calls the divine imagination. And so by simply stopping our habitual patterns of thinking and planning and stressing, just by stopping, we can observe something that is always there, has always been there, world without end. From the moment we incarnated, and a level of consciousness will be there even when we leave this mortal coil. And the opportunity is to know that now, in this holy instant that is always the holy instant that is always inviting us in. We have a sign over my head, a calligraphy that was written by Thich Nhat Hanh, the Buddhist saint. And it says, I have arrived, I am home. It speaks volumes to the soul, because the soul wants to come home to the truth of its very being, not its skin-encapsulated ego with a lot of issues, but to come home to a presence and a power and a love that is so vast that it, by its very nature, embraces everyone and everything. A friend reminded me this morning in our revealing service to go stand under a tree and to feel that ineffable connection to these living expressions that provide oxygen for us to breathe. This morning, we were driving the car to take the dogs for a walk, and my husband and I passed the old maple tree where we taught our little dog, Baby Speck, how to fetch a ball. And in a holy instant, we pulled the car over, we got out of the car, and we walked over to this maple tree. And for just an instant, we saw her lying there as a puppy on her back, and we were rubbing her belly. And it's as if she was there. What's so beautiful about having sacred memories like that, we touch upon that life that is still here with us, even though the form may be gone. And although the world may think we're strange, there is a beautiful gift in realizing there is no death. All that dies is the form, but the spirit is still there. And so if you have loved ones that maybe have made their transition, or maybe some loved ones that are going through a transition, I recently lost my sister-in-law. The opportunity then is to identify them not as the form that they were, but as the spirit that they still are. And so we come here on Sunday mornings to access this inner guidance system, a guidance system that comes from life itself, a life that was never born and never dies. The opposite of death isn't life, the opposite of death is birth, but there's something that was never born and never dies, and that is life itself. And so we come here to experience this life, the flow of this life. And this month of November, I'm speaking on living in the flow of the one life. And specifically today, I'm going to be accessing the ideas of living from within outwardly. We have a tendency in the world to look at the outward, and as Jesus says, we take the storm on the outside, and oftentimes we put that storm on the outside on the inside, and then we're a mess. So what if the gift and the opportunity and the challenge and the responsibility for all of us is to live from within that peaceful place, the eye of the storm, to live from the silence out of which the noise arises, out of which thoughts arise. But instead of identifying with thought patterns and a lot of noise and a lot of chaos in the world, we identify with that stillness, that still small voice. It doesn't get louder, but it gets clearer when we become still. And so we come here this Sunday morning to access this outflowing from this divine presence within ourselves, and to invite that flow of peace, divine peace, to invite that flow of clarity amidst the confusion that the mind might have, to invite that love and compassion amidst the concern and other tangled, troubled emotions, to know that behind all the surface noise, there is something in the deep, from the deep, which is our true nature. And as Emerson says, when deep calls upon deep, deep always responds. So we are here to go deep, referencing the tree that the friend pointed to. Rumi says, return to the root of the root of the root of the self. So this Sunday, let's access the wisdom of that deep that we have called upon, to live from that resource, that ever-flowing fountain of truth, of life, of awareness, of consciousness, unencumbered by addictive thought patterns of me. Let us access that wisdom that comes from Source itself. And when we access it, we are resourced. We recognize, we realize, we remember that we are that we are all that. And that is free. That is free of me and my story and my trauma. That which we are is awake, aware, alive, and is ready to explore this beautiful intimacy of belonging to the one that knows no other, and we are that one. This is a consciousness of oneness. One life, one love, one truth, unveiling itself yet again, uniquely to each one of us. I invite you now to open your eyes, put your hands over your heart, feel that something within you that is very intimate to you. It's a felt experience. It's a felt knowing. And we can feel our way into the truth without having to have any thought whatsoever. Okay, when you're ready, you can put your hands down. Situate yourself in your chair. Maybe adjust your mask if you need to. It's so lovely to see all your beautiful faces. My beloved Jake over here reminded me that he works in retail. He said people come in and they're wearing their masks. And he said, sometimes I don't recognize them as I didn't recognize Katie. But he says, I can look into their eyes and I see into their soul. So what if one of the gifts of this pandemic is that we get to look into the eyes of the soul wherever we look into the world and we get to see ourselves reflected? You know, there's a wonderful saying that says, you don't see what is, you only see who you are. So if what you're looking out there and you're seeing the enemy, if you're seeing the problem, it's the problem that's looking and it's projecting itself out into the world. I sat on my porch with a dear friend of mine who came over, who's an Anamkara, a soul friend, and there's so many Anamkaras out here in this audience. And she and I were discussing this challenge that we face on the planet right now. Things are very fractured. It's kind of a scary time, as Keisha reminded me. There could be political upheaval. We don't know what's going to happen. I hear phrases of civil war, and then I don't even want to go down that path when they talk that way. And yet, speaking with my friend on the front porch, she reminded me that sometimes things have to seem really dark before they shift. And she was a 12-step person, and she said, I learned in the 12-step program that sometimes you have to hit bottom before you're ready to change. So I'm hoping that our country has hit bottom in so many ways, especially around the environment, especially around science, because I care about the forests and the trees and the water and what we're going to leave our kids and our grandkids. And I don't want to play the game that it doesn't matter what your carbon footprint does, it impacts. It does matter. I'm a big gardener, and it's so funny. I was looking out my windows at my beautiful garden, and we were this morning reflecting on the trees haven't been changing colors the way they did in the past. And of course, my husband says, I think that's the global warming thing. It's gotten so much warmer now. He said, it's more like we live in Birmingham or North Florida. And so normally the trees that would be bright gold and red are still green. They're like 2-3 weeks behind in turning colors. So, you know, just to have an awareness around that, to be curious, you know, what is going on here? I have camellia japonicas in my yard. I have like 10 of them. When I originally bought the house, we had 2 sasanquas. Now, sasanquas are fall-blooming camellias. And right by the front of the house, there's a huge white one hanging this way, cascading over, and another white one on the other side of the house, and they're in full bloom. And they're northern-blooming camellias. So I thought that was all I was restricted to until we got warmer here. I was told you can't grow the japonicas this far north in North Alabama. Well, now my japonicas, and I think there's got 10 of them, they're as healthy as horses. They bloom in the spring. They're not supposed to grow here, nor is the palm tree that's in my front. You're not supposed to grow here. I wonder if it's global warming or if it's just fake news. I think there's something warmer going on. And of course, my husband of 45 years, he keeps copious notes ever since 1978 of weather every single day. And his big concern, Michael, he's 72, is he says, when I die, who am I going to leave my weather books to? If you're still alive, Michael, I'm leaving them to you. He's got weather books from 1978 to the present, and he's crazy. He keeps charts, and guess what these charts are showing? That the temperature's going up. And he keeps articles from newspapers and all these strange aberrations that happen all over the planet. And of course, he's so concerned why we can't get it around the environment. He says, everything else I can kind of let go, but his empath is for the trees and for this planet and for the water and for the fish and for the vanishing species. So that's his empathic concern. And being that I'm married to him, I have to show empathy toward his concern, that this is something serious. It's not something that we should pretend is fake. It's something real. So could we be willing to have those conversations and not be threatened by them, not feel that we're offending people, that we're just speaking the truth the way I see it? You know, I was sharing with our circle this morning, the one concern that really affects me is the way we treated those little kids when they yanked them from the mothers and put them in cages at the border. And it's something, you talked about Keisha going to do something. I've thought many a time, I just want to go right down there and take those kids and hold them in my arms and tell them I love them. Because I remember being a little kid and feeling abandoned at one stage and feeling lost. And how, what a trauma it did to me until my mother did find me. I was lost in a big department store, and no one could find my mother, and I remember standing and crying at the door. And then maybe an hour later, she found me. Now, that was 1 hour. Can you imagine what they go through for months and months and months? So could we invite the empathic one within ourselves and consider it a gift and a blessing? Because when you have compassion for the least of these, my friend Jean has compassion for butterflies, and so she takes the little caterpillars, instead of letting the birds feast off of her dill bush, she decides, I'm going to take you little babies, at least some of you, in the house and give you another chance at life. That would be an empathic action, what she's doing. Other people, our house was being infested by squirrels, and they were literally digging into the attic. And I love squirrels because they're in the trees, but when they're digging a hole into your attic, you get a little disarmed. And so I called up the tree man and the squirrel man, the exterminator man, and he says, you need to get a gun and shoot them out of the trees. And I said, no, I don't shoot squirrels out of trees. And then he says, well, I'm going to put some traps here and we're going to catch them. And then I said, and then I'll have a half-dead squirrel hanging from a trap. Well, you just call me up and I'll come over and I'll get rid of them. And I thought, oh my God, the things you have to do to be squirrel-free. So to those squirrels' benefits, I just said to them, look it, you just need to live in the trees and not in my house. And every single squirrel, without exception, left the attic, overcame those traps. Not one trap caught one squirrel. They all left, and Alberto came and he patched the holes, and not one was sacrificed to the exterminator. Now that was an empathic thing that I felt really good about at the end. So this month I was sharing in the opening meditation, I pulled out my In the Flow of Life book, written in 1974 by Eric Butterworth, and he was a Unity minister in New York City. He was competing with Raymond Charles Barker, who spoke at Alice Tully Hall. They had the two biggest New Thought churches in the movement at the time, and this is the remake of his 1974 book, 1994, remake of In the Flow of Life. And Eric Butterworth talks about living in a flow where the universe is the source of everything, and I can access that source. So as if you were Jesus, you would say, I of myself do nothing. It's this Father within that doeth the work. He called it Abba, which means beloved. So there's this beloved energy that uses each one of us. And then we become a conduit, an opening through which the Christ plays its music, through which the awakened consciousness discovers the mystery of belonging to the universe. The shamans have known it forever. So could we allow ourselves, Mother Teresa, I am a pencil in the hand of God. I am an instrument through which God expresses, through which God loves, through which God reveals itself. Then we become the opening through which it happens. Now, at the very beginning in the introduction to the new book, he says, I'm not here to inform you of anything. To inform you of something is to give you thoughts and ideas. He says, rather, I'm here to outform you. Oh, that sounds funny. What does he mean by outform? He says, to outform, I mean that I am not concerned with putting ideas into your mind, but rather with awakening your own superconscious awareness in which things can be known. There is something within us that knows, even when we don't know. One of the greatest spiritual mind treatments that says, help, I don't have a clue what to do, but I know that there is something which does. Katie's beautiful boyfriend, he's going through a challenge with his mother, making her transition. I've been through so many transitions, and I certainly don't know what to do, but when I show up in the moment, something does, and frequently it just takes over. When Vandana made her transition and she was so desperate with life, breathing heavily, looking at me with her eyes, help me, and she was in intensive care, instantly when the family left the room, which is always necessary, I says, look in my eyes and breathe with me. And I was breathing slow and steady, and she was breathing very rapidly and very troubled. I said, I'm going to slip out of my physical body into my light body, and I invite you to slip out of your physical body into your light body. I says, can you feel my arm around you? And she nodded her head, just like Katie did. And her reference point for belonging to the universe was Krishna. I says, Krishna's waiting for you. If she were a Christian, I probably would say Jesus is waiting for you. You know, if she was a Muslim, maybe I'd say Allah is waiting for you. But I knew that Krishna was her reference point. And I said, I'm just dancing you into the light, and Krishna's waiting. And I watched her breath get slower and slower and slower, and one last long exhalation. And then this troubled soul, a smile just formed on her face, and it never left her face. So that was confirmation that she had returned to the light. When her husband came into the room, he screamed and threw himself, come back, don't leave me. To which she gave one more breath, looked at him and exhaled, it's merciful for me to go now. So what if that's the outflowing? If something knows how to do it. He says there's this outformation. Information is knowledge, but he says outformation is wisdom that's unfolded by the intuition that naturally flows forth into ourselves and manifests as our experience. So could we be willing to be in the flow of that, whatever that is? For Terry, it might be creativity as she works at her potter's wheel. You know, anybody who's creative knows that inspiration comes. I wrote my master's thesis when I was in graduate school on the anatomy of inspiration. I was curious about where did all the great artists, the musicians and the poets, where? And without exception, they say there is a stream whose source is hidden, and from whence it comes, I know not. But when it comes, I'm a pensioner. I draw from that thing. And then it can flow through me and express as me, whether it's poetry or music or whatever. I am not the doer, Jesus would say. This something else is the doer. So he goes on to say, people are not in the world to set it right, but we're here to see it rightly. That's really profound. You know, we're not here to fix the world, but we're here to see the world rightly. So when the world looks like it's falling apart, well, maybe it is falling apart, so that something can give birth. Have you ever been in a relationship that was so toxic that it had to die in order for a new life form to emerge? Am I the only one? Have you ever been in a job that you said was killing you, only to stay in it until it almost does kill you? And then maybe you're ready to let it go, and then a whole new life starts to happen within you? But it wouldn't have happened had that relationship not ended. It wouldn't have happened had that identity with that career. And even though it might have been traumatic at the time, it was necessary for the light to emerge. So you begin to see things differently. We're not here to set the world right. We're here to see it rightly. So there's an invitation. How am I seeing the world? Am I seeing the world as a problem to be fixed? Well, then I need to go fix it. Or am I seeing the world as a beautiful possibility waiting to happen? I am very hopeful. Gene and I live in the world of hope. Some people call it a fantasy world. But I am hoping that we awaken on this planet and we recognize that they're all our children and that we are all the mother. Those children at the border are just as much my children as those triplets of yours are. And so when I know that, I see the world rightly, in my opinion. Not only are those children my children, but those butterflies are my children. And the trees are my children. And I am here to be their mother. What does a mother do? She nurtures. She embraces. Because we're all one. We're all the mother. I got that phrase from a beautiful black woman in South Africa. I arrived there in 1999. It was around Christmas time. And she was the first speaker at the Parliament of the World Religions. And she stood up on that stage. I can still see her in Cape Town. And she said, I lost all five of my children to AIDS. And she said, I want you to know that they weren't my children. They're our children. And she said, and there were a lot of orphans in the streets. And she said, these are all our children. And then she said, and we are all the mother. It is not just me. And that went through me like a lightning bolt. We are all the mother and they're all our children. Now, when you see the world in those eyes, well, then what action would you take? Even if it's just to open your heart. Eric Butterworth comes out of the Unity tradition and it's far more Christian. So the book is just filled with Jesus and all the prophets, and that's great. So he starts off by quoting Jesus. And Jesus said, the kingdom of heaven is within you. The kingdom of heaven is at hand. And then he goes on, Butterworth says, it is the right seeing of this that is the key to experiencing it. In fact, right seeing leads to an actually outforming of it. When you know that the kingdom is within you, the kingdom is the consciousness of the one. That's what it means. He used the word Malkutha, which is the sovereign counsel of God. So this kingdom is within you. It's counseling you. It's guiding you. Could we let it outflow from us? Just naturally. Could we breathe it in and breathe it out? And then if you get kind of crazy like me and you get really curious, what would that feel like? Well, it would feel compassionate, wouldn't it? It would feel like love. Jesus' last words would just love one another as I've loved you. Jesus would say, forgive 70 times 7. If you've done it to the least of these, you've done it to me. Jesus would say, be like a lily of the field. They toil not, neither do they struggle. Yet Solomon in all his splendor was not arrayed as one of these. So he's saying, flow like a flower. Flow like a flower. They don't struggle. They live effortlessly, easily. So they're pointing the way. And that's all any of the great teachers have done. I was listening to Ramana Maharshi the other day. There's several YouTube videos on him, and he was an awakened being. He was born in 1880. By the time he was 16, he awoke like Jesus did to his true nature. He says, I am not me, the one that you see. I am this substratum of pure awareness and pure consciousness that we all are. And so he left his family and he lived in Arunachala on this mountain for the rest of his life, courting with this kingdom of heaven within him. And he says, this kingdom is transmitted in the silence. But he says, we in the world seem to need words. So he said, I'll have to arise in my mind and try to cloak it with words, even though words are far inferior to having that direct experience of that presence, of that ineffable something that awakens when it awakens. And then when you stop seeking it, like Marie did, you realize that you're not the seeker, you're the sought. It finally found you. It awoke within you. And this presence, this Buddha consciousness, this Christ consciousness, it awakens when it's ready to awaken. Oftentimes it needs a little bit of a 2x4, because so many of us get stuck in thinking we've got the answers. We've got to move out of the expert consciousness into the beginner's mind. Most people don't want to go to beginner's mind. So this is right seeing. And then he quotes the Apostle Paul. The Apostle Paul says, don't let the world around you squeeze you into its own mold. He says, but rather let God remold your mind from within. Stop conforming to the world. The world doesn't have your good. Stop trying to get their approval. And he says, let God mold you from within. Now take that into your curious little self, into your curious little soul. What would my life be like if I let this divine love mold me? If I let this creative presence express as me? If I allow this peace that passeth all understanding to be what I am, not a neurotic, chaotic, frenetic person who's just saying life is so sick and hard, because Moses says the words in your mouth are a blessing or a curse according to how you use it. So if you say life is hard and if it sucks, don't be surprised then if it does, because you have programmed that into your own belief system. But when you start saying life is fascinating, and like a shaman, it's showing me from every tree that these are all my relations. And then the bird begins to show you that be like a bird who, pausing for a while on boughs too slight, feels them give way beneath her, yet sings, knowing she hath wings. And so then the lilies of the field preach to you, and the birds preach to you, and the trees preach to you, and the rock preaches to you. And you become, oh my God, I'm beginning to listen, not with my ears, but with my soul. And I'm discovering the meaning. So, after Paul, he says, if you can just get into the flow of the universe, which is within you, you will experience an immediacy of presence. And he uses the capital P word, presence. The presence of God and the clarity of mind. Huh. I can see clearly now. The pain has gone. I can see all the obstacles in my way. Gone are the dark clouds that had me blind. It's going to be a bright, bright, sunshiny day. You begin to even hear music with different ears. I can see clearly now because I'm no longer struggling with my belief system, with my opinions, with my judgments. You know, so he says this presence and this clarity is within you. And then he references one of the Beatitudes, blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. So what if all we're here to do, and last month I did a beautiful series on Ram Dass, Polishing the Mirror of the Heart. Once you polish this mirror of the heart, then it only sees God everywhere. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God, because it's all God. Then you see God in the smallest of things. Meister Eckhart said, he could see God in the smallest of things better than seeing an angel. And yet we want to see angels, and we want to see all these, otherworldly things, when you can see God in the smallest of things. Picking up a flower. When I was a little boy, when I was this mystical little boy, we were all little mystics when we were children, I used to pick up flowers and I'd fall into the flower. And then when I started studying this mystical stuff, as an adult, I'd pick up a flower and fall into the flower. And I think Katie called me Swami Floral one time. It's at one stage of when she was here at the center. And then he goes on to link this New Thought Christianity to Hinduism. And he says, the word I, remember, blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. The word I comes from the Sanskrit root word, which means fountain. And he says, this is beautifully significant, for when your mind is remolded from within, you are synchronized with the omnipresent flow of God, which streams out in the very act of seeing. You see from the consciousness of God. Thus you actually project this consciousness toward anything that your eye beholds. Wheresoe'er I look, I see the face of God. Because when you know that you are looking through God's eyes, God will only see itself mirrored. The world is a reflection of who we are. That's why Jesus in his wisdom said to love the enemy, because if you're seeing the enemy out there, you have projected it out into the world. So could we absolve ourselves of enemies and know that they're showing us our own blocked energy? So when you talk about being in the flow, I think one of the key things is to notice where you're blocked from that flow and to carry that in. Where am I blocked? Am I caught into any judgment? Am I defensive? You're blocked if you're defensive, if you're judging, if you're worried. I quoted Paul throughout the whole month of October. Paul said, when there are chaotic times, these are the three things you do. And I love it when they give you a simple formula. The first thing is to not worry. Now, that's hard for most people in the Western world, especially during this time. So he says, and you know what you understand in New Thought? Worry is a faith in a limited idea. So if you're so worried, you're literally causative of it happening. So not to worry time. This is how shift happens. The second thing he said was, in all you're asking, do it with a grateful heart. Could we be grateful that we still live in a democracy? Could we be grateful that we have chairs to sit in a beautiful community and that we have masks and that we're smart enough to wear them? Could we be grateful that our children are doing well? You know, that you want to come in the sanctuary? You're welcome to come in. You don't have to stand back there. I don't know who you are, but you're handsome in your mask. And the third thing Paul said to do, and this to me was the most profound one. Oh, it's Katie's boyfriend. The third thing is, Paul said, notice the peace that is always there, even in the midst of this chaos. It's the eye at the center of the storm. And he says, let that peace guard your hearts and guard your minds. I've been living with this every single day. When my heart gets upset as an empath, I go into the peace and I breathe into that peace. When my mind runs away with a stinking thought that spirals me out and, you know, what if this and what if that, I let that peace claim my attention. And you know, the most valuable possession any of us has is our attention. So what are we putting our attention on? If we put our attention on a problem, the problem gets bigger. But if we put our attention on the peace and the gratitude and the part of us that doesn't worry, that says, this is how change happens. You know, there was a young lady here and her relationship is challenged and it may end. And of course, she's very upset. But I remind her so lovingly, if I can, that she's safe, it's just change. When I was working with the AIDS crisis in Louise Hay, and these young men were dropping like flies, we would do a chant every time. Louise Hay called them the Hay Rides. And the chant was, doors closing, doors opening, doors closing, doors I'm opening. Even if that door that we're opening is death, I am safe, it's only change, I am safe, it's only change. To let someone know, even at their deathbed, that it's okay to go, that they're safe, because they're an eternal soul, and who they are will never die. I was telling the group here that I've held so many in my arms, and it's one of the most beautiful sacred moments with both mom and dad when they made their transition. And essentially I was saying that they're safe, that it's changed, and that I'll take care of everything. And the truth is that we don't die. We just change form. So lastly, he says, what you see, you become, because of this outforming process of the mind. What you see, you become. So you get to ask, what am I seeing? What eyes am I looking through? What am I becoming? Am I becoming the problem or am I becoming the solution? Am I becoming the lover or am I becoming the one that filled with hate and fear? He says, I'm not interested in simply informing you about truth, but rather I'm interested in awakening in you the consciousness of a dynamic flow of life, so that you may experience a progressive outforming of this flow in creative and dynamic ways in every aspect of your life, to be living in the flow of the One. And so this whole little book is going to be inspiring me, hopefully through this month, and we need the flow more than ever during this time of transition on our planet. We need to allow this flow to happen from that awakened place, from that healed place, from the wholeness of our being. And it's all about how we see. Ernest Holmes in The Science of Mind said something so simple but yet so profound. He said, it's the perception of wholeness that is all healing. When you perceive the wholeness amidst the disjointedness on the planet, your perception is causative. This perception, could I see there is wholeness underneath what seems to be chaotic? And wholeness emerges sometimes when the appearance falls away, then that wholeness can emerge again. You know, when I was young and I thought my love was outside me in the world, I kept looking for love out there. And when the relationship after relationship fell away and I'm 21 and I'm bereft because I had the whole thing wrong, as tragic as that might have been for a 21-year-old, it took me within. And I found that the thing I was looking for, like enlightenment, was right there at the center of my being. The love was not out there. And when that love began to awaken, then I realized this love saw love everywhere. Everyone became my lover. I mean everyone, I mean every bug and every tree. You know, I put little traps out for the cockroaches, and yet when I see one in the kitchen sink, I seem to scoop it up as an empath and carry it outside and release it to its greater good. So I kind of absolve myself of any guilt from having killed a few in the traps. I'm just going to give you just a taste, teeny bit more. There's a young David Leonard. Hoi vey. Today we're talking about living from within out, and so much of the world lives from without in. We like to deal with the situations out here, and we let it affect who we are. But this particular chapter is living from within outward, and here's how he puts it. Solomon says, "For as he thinketh in his heart, so is he." So what are you thinking in your heart? That's what you're projecting out into the world. It's a wonderful thing to inquire, who am I being in this moment? What am I projecting out into the world? And to rest there. As a man thinketh in his heart, so is he. So then he goes on to say, as a unity minister, and you know, we work with the power of thought in New Thought. It's called New Thought for a reason. He says, thought of itself does not create anything. Huh. You're not your thoughts. Ernest Holmes says, separate the thoughts from the thinker. You're the thinker. Throw the thoughts away. Most of the thoughts are all confused anyway. He said, it either places us consciously in a universal flow, or it frustrates the flow itself. The thing called thought. So he says, in the same sense, if we think health or abundance, we do not create health or abundance. He says, there's no way that man can create health or abundance. He says, rather, it is a flow or a flowering of the divine life itself. When you know that you are this divine love, it flows through you and it expresses and reveals itself. When you know you're the abundance of the universe in every way, then everything. I'm a most abundant person I know. In Think and Grow Rich, they talk about the five levels of abundance. The highest level of abundance is to have peace of mind. I can actually say I'm a very peaceful man until the moments I'm not. So could I access the peace of the universe? The second highest level of abundance is health. And if you've ever been challenged with a health challenge, you know that health is the law of my life. And by affirming that, I'm affirming the health of the universe. I'm affirming the health of life itself is my health. You know, then the third highest quality of abundance is healthy relationships. To have a healthy relationship where you're peaceful and you're holding your beloved's hand. Have you ever been in a toxic relationship where you went in the house and you thought it was, I've been in those toxic relationships. To know now that I only create healthy, loving relationships, that's the third level of abundance. The fourth level of abundance is your expression, your creative self-expression. You might say it's your work. A beautiful man here, he gave up his job, and now he's delivering Chick-fil-A's 2 hours a day, and he said, I've never been happier, because I don't have some you-know-what telling me what to do. I get in my car, I get the address, I drop it off, they smile with their mask on, give me a tip, and he said, I've learned to make my work manageable. The fifth level of abundance is money. And even then, it's not the amount of money, it's how you are in the flow of money. I know that I'm really prosperous when I can give it away as freely as I can receive it. And then money circulates. That's truly an abundant person knows how to circulate. My husband gives huge tips to waitresses. They'll serve us dinner and he'll give a $50 tip. And I said, that's a little excessive. And he says, but I can do it. Why shouldn't I do it? He said, she smiled at me. And you know, I love that quality that he has, you know? So, last but not least, he says, we simply accept it, this natural flow, by consenting to it. And this is what the presence of God really is. It's the life of God present in us as an inexorable flow. We're opening and just saying, yes, use me. Use this life as you will. All there is this flow. And he says, it is simply our consent. We have a little painting out in the foyer by Sharon Ledford, and it says, yes, 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 in one big spiral, 1,000 times yes. Consent to life, whatever life is giving you. If it's giving you the pain of an empath, say yes to that pain. If it's giving you concern for your children, say yes to that concern. If it's giving you sadness and grief for the loss of a loved one, say yes to that sadness. It's all coming to cleanse you. So when those emotions come knocking at the doorway of your heart and soul, you invite them in and you sit them down. They're coming to clean us out. And we don't need to deny them and pretend they don't exist. You know, your tears are sacred anytime you allow them to flow. He says, our way of saying yes to the flow, which is the Father's good pleasure in us and for us. Remember that beautiful line from Scripture, and there's a lot of it in here. It's the Father's good pleasure to give you the kingdom. Now, the kingdom we've already recognized as this resource of the divine flow, and it's already been given. So could we consent and say yes to it? I am open and receptive to this divine flow, and I give myself as an inlet and an outlet for the passageway of its wisdom, its beauty, its creativity, its love. Jesus' final words, in the world you have tribulation, he says, but I have overcome the world. I have overcome my identification with the world. I am a spiritual being having a human experience, and that human experience isn't the truth of me. The spirituality is the truth of me, and I can put it with the human, and then I'm divinely human and humanly divine. So he goes on to say, we so easily get out of the consciousness of this flow of spirit. And the invitation is to get back in that flow. So let's do a closing meditation about getting back in that flow. Of course, we never got out of it. And to give consent to this ineffable something that is breathing us, to this love that is flowing through us. If you can't access that love right now, I'll give you a little trick. I learned this from the Sufis. They say, imagine someone that you dearly love. It could be an animal, a pet, it could be a grandparent, it could be a beloved one, a friend. And as you image them in your mind's eye, feel how that engenders a certain quality within your heart of love, of acceptance, of compassion, especially if they're suffering. And now let that image of them just kind of dissolve like a snowflake would in a warm cup of tea. And all that's left is that beautiful liquid love that remains. And you are resting in that love, as that love. And you are becoming an open expression for that love to flow. It flows in with each breath and flows out with each exhalation. It doesn't target any specific object in the world, unless, of course, you want it to, but rather we are basking in a flow of love itself. Rumi says, all swimming in that ocean of love ends in drowning. And what that says to me is that all that drowns is the one that perceives him or herself as separate from the love, and that all that remains then is the ocean of love. And so we come here to swim in the ocean of love and then drown in that, only metaphorically, and know that we are that love flowing. And now if we take that vibrational field into our field of perception and imagine when we come out of this brief meditation, we look through our eyes and we're still established in that flow of love, we're going to see through the eyes of love. And as Ernest Holmes said, love sees only love. And then he followed up by saying, and only love sees love. And so when we know ourselves as a flow of love, we begin to see it everywhere. And so when we hear that original statement, we're not here to set the world right, but we're here to see it rightly. Could we see this world through the eyes of love? Could we see this world as the potential and possibility of an awakened soul where something beautiful like a phoenix rising from the ashes is happening in our country, in our democracy, within our community. I voted recently and there were so many young people standing in line to vote, many of them for their first time, all social distancing, all wearing masks, and I found myself praising them. I said, it is so beautiful to see you young people out here expressing your right to vote. That was love expressing itself. And so as we approach whatever challenges that life brings us from a loving consciousness, we can then ask, who am I to be? And out of that being, what needs to be done? And could we do the doing from the beingness? Beingness always precedes doing. So we open to this being loving in this holy instant. We open to this being peaceful in this holy instant. We open to this being free of judgment and accepting the world just as it is in this holy instant. We open to curiosity and fascination as we live in the question, not necessarily seeking answers, but living in the fertile question where the mind is 10 times more active. How might I be more loving in this scenario? Is a question we often ask. Another question, what is blocking me from this flow? And then listen. Maybe what's blocking me is a worried thought. And then I hear Paul saying, not to worry time. And then I hear Paul saying, in your asking, do it with a grateful heart. And gratitude begins to flower within me. And so as we realize that we are working only on our own consciousness, as we establish ourselves in this consciousness of oneness, in this consciousness of peace, love, and joy, we begin to see through the eyes of that. We begin to create that in the world, because the world is an outforming of our own informing. And this is living from within outward. The kingdom of heaven is within, Jesus said. And he said, if you let that which is within you express, that which is within you will save you. He also said, if you do not allow that which is within you to express, that which is within you will destroy you. And so he is, in his own dramatic way in the Gospel of Thomas, inviting us to discover this kingdom, this sovereign counsel of God, and to be a conduit for that. A conduit is an opening. And so we say to this divine loving presence, this life is your life. Do with it as you will, in the highest service to the one and in highest service to the all. From that sacred place within your own heart, I invite you to place your hands over your heart and join with me in the heart salutation, which says, I honor you.
I honor you.
I respect you.
I respect you.
I love you.
I love you.
You are the deepest aspect of myself.
You are the deepest aspect of myself.
The beloved in me bows to the beloved in you.
The beloved in me bows to the beloved in you.
In this space we are one.
In this space we are one.
And now symbolically, let's open our hands and open that space, that heart space, and let's see it moving out into the world and whip a little fingers. So that we identify with the body, we are a body with a soul, and a soul with a body, and it shines brightly. So thank you for coming, and thank you for your tithes, and go vote, and wear your mask.
Listening to our podcast. For more information, please visit www.cslhuntsville.org.